7:01, in attendance are Representative Gruenberg, Representative Herron, myself, Representative Ramirez, and Representative Gatto. Jane Pearson is out. Margaret Dowling, thank you very much for assisting us today. We are flattered, pleased, and delighted to have the very busy co-chair of House Finance, our colleague, Representative Hawker, presenting House Bill 319. Our intention is to hear it and to excuse you unless you find it necessary to be here. Mr. Sponsor, we're well aware of the charge that you're leading on behalf of the state, and it certainly will be the hope of the chair to try and expedite this bill from committee. Mr. Hawker, are you presenting?
Yes, sir.
Nice to see you. We anticipate our other members arriving shortly. Representative Lynn is on the phone. Representative Dahlstrom's things are here, and Representative Holmes is doing better every day at being punctual.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that delightful
introduction. Wait. She's usually here, you know.
It's you. Okay. That's right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, she also has a bill up in Senate Judiciary.
All right.
So we'll strike that from the record.
Representative Hawker, we are so happy to have you before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, it is another great pleasure to be here. You know, I think I've been in your committee twice in like 5 days, and that's more than I've been here in 5 years in the legislature. So hopefully we're doing something right today. Mr. Chairman, I am offering a bill that gives us another opportunity as legislators to affirm the Second Amendment rights of Alaska citizens. The bill really has two arenas. One is sort of I'm hesitating to use quite the word ministerial, but some legislative cleanup to existing statute regarding concealed carry permits. Each of the items involved there was brought to me in my office by constituents from various quarters around the state. And Mr. Chairman, if it's all right to mention this, this bill was originally going to be brought forward by the then Representative Coghill, and I worked with his staff to be putting this bill together.
What happened to him?
He just disappeared. And with Representative Coghill becoming Senator Coghill, his staff asked me to pick up the sponsorship of this bill and bring it forward to the committee. Mr. Chairman, very quickly, the three areas that are affect concealed carry law. One is that it just clarifies the language that makes it very explicitly clear that when a permit is expired or somebody leaves the state, you do not have to surrender the permit. Now, I would acknowledge that, if a very literal reading of statute makes it appear that that needs to be done. It has been administratively managed in that manner, but again, I've been asked by Alaskan citizens to make it clear in statute. The second one is also one of those, it's a words mean things provision.
Can you hurry it along a little bit, Representative Hawker?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Asking that a permit can be displayed. The key point here, there's a fellow in Fairbanks who possesses one of the first, it's one of your constituents, Mr. Ramirez, or at least potentially, that a permit, an expired concealed carry permit, can be displayed, such as decoratively on a wall in a frame. A fellow that brought this to us possesses one of the first permits issued. He's quite proud of it. He was instrumental in passing the bill. But the statute actually says you can't display a permit. Well, this is a clarification point that says you can't display it without essentially, when you're attempting to defraud someone into convincing someone that the permit's valid when it isn't. It sort of clarifies the intent language there so that this law-abiding Alaskan citizen does not feel he is violating the letter of the law. The third point is one that is relevant to myself and a lot of others. It just seems a common sense thing, and these permits last for 5 years. Within 90 days of a permit expiring, we simply send folks a letter saying, by the way, your permit's expiring, it's up to you to do something about it. Again, something that's been requested by many members of the firearms community in the state. Next part of the bill is one that really gets to it makes a positive affirmation and truly a policy call on our part to affirm the Second Amendment rights of Alaska citizens. There's a class of firearms that are those firearms registered under the National Firearms Act of 1934, and those would be firearms that would include certainly the colorful firearms, sound suppressors, machine guns and what is called destructive devices, but it means it's a firearm larger than 50 caliber. Those firearms are legal to possess in the state of Alaska, have always been, and there are many thousands of them possessed by Alaskans. But in order to possess one of these firearms, you have to seek permission from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That permission, there's an application form in the document to show you what's required. Essentially, to get this federal permission, an individual has to submit their fingerprints, photographs, and undergo a complete and total FBI background check before the permission is granted. And then that permission actually involves a transfer tax of $200 that also has to be paid. Now, as part of the federal bureaucracy overstepping its own bounds, they, by regulation, have added a provision that is not in federal law, but it's in federal regulation, that says on this application form, a local, what is called the CLEO, the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the person's residency, must sign a negative assurance provision. And that language is in your packet. It's in the back part of the form, and I think it's also been stated there in the written materials I provided. But the negative assurance, and particularly for Mr. Chairman, for Representative Grunberg, who would appreciate being the specificity of this, it is negative assurance. And if I might read for you, Mr. Chairman, the assurance that the local law enforcement officer must provide for an individual citizen before they submit this form. And I want to emphasize, the form then requests a complete background federal FBI examination for your qualifications and, the fingerprints, photographs, and everything. But the certification for the local guy is, I certify that I am the chief law enforcement officer of the organization named below, having jurisdiction in the area of residence of the name of the transferee. No, I have no information, negative assurance, I have no information indicating that the transferee will use the firearm or device described in this application for other than lawful purposes. I have no information, negative assurance again, that the receipt or possession of the firearm or device described in item 4 would place the transferee in violation of state or local law. And then the individual law enforcement officer has to sign this. This sign-off has been used by, frankly, I think abused by some local law enforcement officers who themselves have said, I do not want to approve firearms transfers whatsoever, and so I will just simply not do this. And in other places, that's changed, but from an administration to an administration, some communities have had suddenly a mayor come in that was anti-firearms, directed their chief law enforcement officer not to sign these. This bill would then say, actually says that if the chief law enforcement officer cannot make the affirmative statement that they have no information or cannot not make that statement, that they have 30 days to complete this task, to do it for an Alaska citizen who is otherwise a law-abiding citizen. For the local person to do that, it's really not an awful lot different than just run it just like you're running somebody when you stop somebody for a vehicle check or otherwise. Nothing comes up, and you've got to believe that the chief law enforcement officer of any agency would be aware of any investigations going on that might give them an indication that the transferee would be illegal. Without that, then, what we're saying is that we are just simply saying that CLEO must sign this within 30 days and then send the actual application into the FBI for the complete and total background check of the individual's qualifications for possession. And the possession of the firearm is accomplished under the authority of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. It's not under the authority of the locally certifying law enforcement officer. Mr. Chairman, again, very important items to a number of Alaska citizens, particularly those most law-abiding citizens in the state who truly value their right to possess firearms and have really historically proven to be some of our most upstanding law-abiding citizens, and I'd ask the committee's favorable acceptance of this legislation, providing them further safety, security, and assurance of their Second Amendment rights.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. We've been joined by Representative Holmes and Representative Lynn. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two quick questions. One is on this Section 3 I'm just trying to make sure, I think I understand what's going on there. I'm just trying to make the language work in my head that if for some reason the law enforcement, the CLIO, actually does have reason to believe that the person is going to use it unlawfully, then they don't have to sign it? Is that correct? I'm trying to...
That would be absolutely correct, ma'am. There's nothing here that says, you know, is to mandate someone do something inappropriate. And the way the language would, through Chair, Representative Ramirez, Representative Holmes, he says, you know, they have got, shall execute within 30 days if a person is qualified under state law to possess the firearm. And you're certainly not qualified under state law if, as in this negative assurance, says the same thing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That cleared up that. Second question is, regarding the title. I had the joy of sitting next to Representative Hawker for my first couple of years on the floor and used to giggle with him about the length of his titles of his bills, which would often go on for, you know, half or three quarters of a page. And so to look and see an act relating to firearms it seemed a lot of character. Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering whether or not the title, I don't have any reason to think I have any problem with this bill. I was just curious whether the title might be a little broad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, I have taken your counsel and gone to shorter titles.
Well said. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any jurisdiction that you're aware of that requires citizens to own guns or carry?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, of Ramirez, somewhere in the back of my mind, anecdotally, I think that's been attempted in a couple of very pro-gun jurisdictions, but it's been more of a demonstrative act than it has been a legally consequential act.
And, Mr. Chair, and the reason I brought it up is the Hurricane Katrina incident where they decided to confiscate weapons, and my first conclusion was they ought to issue them, and that would have done away with an awful lot of the violence. But it just led me to that thought that, I don't know if Switzerland requires citizens to own weapons. I think everyone is armed in Switzerland.
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, to Representative Gatto. First point, the Hurricane Katrina situation, well, I don't believe it has any direct bearing on this bill, or this bill has any direct bearing on it, was, in my opinion, truly an absolute travesty and miscarriage of police authority in an environment, again, absolutely trampling the rights, Second Amendment rights of American citizens. And I think that has been borne out by concerns and the changes made in the federal government for such procedural changes. And then Representative Ramirez, through the chair, to Representative Gatto. I don't pretend to be an expert on Switzerland, but that is one of those. It is a nation state where the citizen members of the organized military forces there do possess state-owned firearms in their homes.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated the sponsor and the chair of the Finance Committee's notice that I look for things. And to do, you know, to follow through on that, I did look for something. And I would call everybody's attention to the law enforcement certification, which is item 17 in somewhat fine print, the federal form. And under where it says name of transferee, the second line down, that sentence now reads, I have no information that the receipt or possession of the firearm or device described in item 4 would be placed the transferee in violation of state or local law. I think that if that's the care that the federal government's using on this, we need to be careful on how much trust we place in them, at least their proofreaders.
Representative Ramirez, I was really hoping Representative Grunberg might not catch that typographic issue with the federal government's forms.
Absolutely. I think House Joint Resolution might be in order on that. But I do have some serious questions here. Item E on page 1, lines 4 and 5, I think we're going to have some folks from the Department of Public Safety, but I'm wondering how that will be effectuated and what the cost will be. And are you able to answer that, or should I ask the folks from Department of Public Safety?
Representative Grunberg, could you point me at your site again, sir?
Yep, page 1, lines 4 and 5.
Oh.
You know, yes. Who has the duty to, what address they're going to use? Do they, is there going to be a duty to notify the department, keep the department informed of their address, et cetera? And what is, how much is it going to cost the department?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, to Representative Grunberg, that responsibility of advising the department exists in current statute. Certainly all we could ever ask by regulation is they would, or that the department would mail the notice to the last known official residence. The fiscal note we've received on that is roughly $36,000 of computer programming costs, which I frankly fully intend to vet rather thoroughly when this bill hopefully reaches my own committee and the Finance Committee. The ongoing cost is estimated to be about $900 a year.
Because I note that through the chair, I don't seem to have a fiscal note in here. So maybe we need to get that. I may have other questions, but that was my main question right now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, the fiscal note was delivered, I believe, this morning to the committee, and I am certain it's up.
It looks like Margaret just given me one. It's from the Department of Law. It's not from the Department of Public Safety. It's a zero fiscal note from a different agency. And I just received that. I don't know if the members have gotten that.
We'll make, we received a copy from DPS that we will have distributed here.
Representative Grunberg?
I'm still.
Representative Lynn?
Division of Elections?
Representative Grunberg?
No, sorry. I may have, as we go along here, go ahead.
We have available to us David Shod, Kathy Monfried, and Kelly Howell with DPS. We also have our favorite state trooper in the great state of Alaska here in uniform, Trooper Rodney Dial, along with his trusty colonel, here available to answer questions. At the appropriate time, I'm going to introduce an amendment for the purposes of discussion. And then I will not be withdrawing the amendment after we discuss it. And I want to bring Trooper Dial up here to have a discussion.
Well, I do have a
Representative Grunberg?
Yeah. I gather that the purpose this is to Representative Hawker through the chair, the purpose of Section 3 in the bill, I gather, is to, since it's already required that they sign this form, that this requires them to do so within 30 days. That's what we're requiring under state law, under Section 3, and that's the purpose of Section 3 of the bill, through the chair to Mr. Hawk.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I'm going to be very careful with choosing my words here. The federal government, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, requires that this form in, that the form include this sign-off by the chief law enforcement officer. There is no legal obligation for the chief law enforcement officer to provide that service to Alaskans. The point of this is it does make it a service that is assured to Alaskans, so that you cannot have an individual who may have an anti-gun bent and is in the position of being a chief law enforcement officer from denying individual Alaskans their constitutional rights.
May I inquire?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Well, under federal law, if we don't have this, suppose the local chief of police refuses to certify, what remedy does the gun holder have then? Are they totally illegal and there's nothing they can do? Do they send it in without a certificate or what?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, at the moment, the CLEO, the chief law enforcement officer, has that authority or implicit authority to just simply to do just that, and there is no remedy or available to the individual citizen.
through the chair, then what does the individual do? Does it send it in? Does the person send it in to the feds without this? Or are they totally illegal? What happens to the legal person, to the citizen?
Chair, Representative Grunberg, what we have in the past where this situation has occurred, we have had an outraged class of Alaska citizens and gun owners railing against government, the actions of individual, capricious actions of individual governmental persons interfering in their Second Amendment rights. They have, and that is what, where the outrage has occurred. There has been no remedy available to these citizens and no assurance that public officials recognize and honor their constitutional rights. That really is why this has been such an important thing. It's occurred in this, historically in the state of Alaska. We've gone through periods where, I'll use our own community, for example, Anchorage. For years, this was a service freely provided by the chief police of the Anchorage Police Department. Years and years and years and years. And then there was a change of personnel, and we had a chief of police who said, no, I'm just not going to do this. And we went for quite a number of years where those of us in the firearms community were fighting you're fighting City Hall trying to get this service reestablished. And it was quite some years ago, and I was personally instrumental in getting that service reestablished under Mayor Wirch. And that process that the Anchorage Police Department has now employed in making these sign-offs is actually, in my opinion, somewhat excessive, but yet it was a compromise. You know, if they're going to do it, they wanted to do it this way, which involved a very much more substantial internal background check of individuals making application than, in my opinion, as a layman, was absolutely necessary. But the fact is, after many years of fighting it, we got the procedure reestablished. There's other communities, again, very recently, in fact, this particular provision was requested by Representative Mignot's when they were having difficulties here in Juneau. We've had concerns raised very recently with the budget cuts in Anchorage that the service might be discontinued. You know, think about this. Discontinuing a service, discontinuing honoring a constitutional right of individual Alaskans. So it really brought forward, I believe, a need for us as public policymakers, and I've never seen the state of Alaska's legislature not affirm the constitutional Second Amendment constitutional rights of Alaska citizens. And it's just one of those times where it's time for us to make that statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, right to the rub of it.
So we have a group of people, when the municipality, let's say in Anchorage, didn't provide this service, did they then submit these applications without us? They didn't submit anything, so they were technically in violation of federal law because of this?
No, Representative Ramirez, Representative Grunberg, you have to complete this application in order to take possession of a restricted firearm.
Oh.
And now we have it completed, but then approved by the federal government before the possession change can occur.
So they weren't able to get the
guns. So they were unable to file the forms. And again, think, you know, and respectfully, and I think you're a gentleman that would very much understand, sir, the inappropriate creating of a privileged and an underprivileged class.
Yeah.
When someone who already legally possessed such a firearm in the community was allowed to continue to possess it, but yet someone new who did not possess one and with equal legal standing was denied the ability to possess the same firearm.
And they couldn't transfer it.
Could not transfer.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that's a serious problem. I'm glad you're hearing this, and I had no idea this was what was going on.
Indeed. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The words shall not be infringed. I take the word infringed very seriously because it doesn't say prohibited or denied. It says infringed. And wouldn't it be an infringement to cause you to be unable to complete a form and submit it? So would that put the city in violation of a federal law?
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, Representative Gatto, that frankly is beyond my legal comprehension or legal skills by any means. I am an accountant, not a lawyer, but it is certainly one of those issues that would be readily debated amongst on the gun club range. And you would have very many people agreeing with you, but it's a point. We don't have to go to that length and really fight to raise that legal question. As far as an individual citizen challenging a local municipality, I just think the cost, the frustration has been prohibitive to have someone really have to fight it all the way to the court system.
Agree.
Representative Grunberg.
I don't know the answer to Representative Gatto's question, but the thing comes to mind, it's either Section 1983 or another section in the Civil Rights Act that talks about denying somebody their constitutional right under color of law. And if they had a duty to do this and they didn't, then conceivably there could be a cause of action for a violation of the civil rights. And that's a serious thing. And some people, I don't know that this is at all what would happen, but it is at least a possibility that somebody, we are right now potentially saving some people from getting sued as law enforcement people or the municipality.
Representative Grunberg, do I take that to mean that you're in support of the bill?
Yeah, well, in that particular, that provision, yeah, we're going through the whole bill, but this provision, I now see what the
problem
was.
Do you think that we could proceed to the parts of the bill that are troubling for you so that we could?
I'm just learning about this. Go ahead. I'm not standing in the way.
Is there any other discussion? Representative Hawker, it's been a pleasure to have you before us in the committee. Is there anybody else in the room that wishes to testify on this bill?
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, you referenced, Finance Committee is meeting upstairs. However, today the good folks are spending a lot of state money in the capital budget up there, so I'm staying down here in hopes that the capital budget doesn't grow too much. I'll be with you for the rest of this hearing.
Oh, excellent.
Good.
I sure would like to put in a good word for the Port McKenzie expansion project. We did a hearing in Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. It's a $57 million project that would create thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs. It's the best capital project I've seen.
Representative,
or none.
Yes.
Better than a crime lab, better than a life science building. I mean, it was impressive.
Representative Foster, it's the best bill you've ever seen. But I assure you, my co-chair looks very favorably upon Port McKenzie port expansion.
It was a remarkable presentation last night, and it will change the Mat-Su Valley. It was fabulous. Representative Grunberg,
yeah, I'd like to have somebody from the Department of Public Safety come up to talk to us about page one, lines 4 and 5, and how that's going to work, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to invite up Lieutenant Dial. Lieutenant Dial, I always like to say it like I'm Forrest Gump. Such a privilege to have you before our committee. We enjoy your presence very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before you is Lieutenant Dial.
I appreciate your, really, seriously, I appreciate your courtesy in letting me have these questions. Lieutenant, I'm looking at subsection E, page 1, lines 4 and 5. I understand from what somebody else has said that right now the Department of Public Safety has the permittee's address on file at all times. Am I correct in that, through the chair?
For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the Department of Public Safety. And through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we do have an expert online that can talk to the specifics of the licensing.
Maybe I should talk to him.
And they would be better suited to answer that.
Maybe we could do that.
Thank you. And Lieutenant Dow, would that be David Shad or Kelly Howe? David Shade?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry,
yes,
I thought it was Shad. Mr. Shade, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
You'd introduce yourself for the record, and then if you can answer Representative Grunberg's question, or else he'd be happy to pose it again.
My name is David Shade. I'm the Director of Statewide Services within the Department of Public Safety, and I'm here with Kathy Monfrida, who is actually the Bureau Chief who deals on direct supervision of the Permits and Licensing Unit, of which that's a part of that unit. As we described in our fiscal note, we intend to automate this process so that programmatically, we are notified of the requirement prior to 90 days to print a expiration notice and through automation have it print that letter and also keep track of when that letter was actually printed and then mail it to the permittee.
How's that, Representative Grunberg?
That is fine. That really does answer my question. And through the chair, Mr. Shade, is that the correct pronunciation of your name, sir, Shade?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay. Mr. Shade, so you would mail it to the to the address on file, then?
That's correct. Through the chair, that's correct. The permittees are required to notify us when there is a change of address, and so the expectation would be that we always have a current address for our permittees.
Okay, fine. I don't think I have any other questions on that.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shea, same question, line 4. And I hope I didn't miss this. The department shall provide a permittee with notice of expiration. There are certainly circumstances where that cannot be done. Was that the question that Representative Grunberg was dealing with? But that, what I see, maybe it should say, shall send a notice of expiration via first-class mail. But it's impossible to guarantee that we can provide one, especially if the person is in Patagonia.
Through the chair, that's correct. We would only send the letter. We wouldn't necessarily know if they had actually received that notice or not.
So, Mr. Chair, then that would be a surefire indication that you cannot satisfy the requirements of the language in the bill under certain circumstances.
Potentially.
Well, I guess that's enough. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, you'll do an amendment to change provide to send.
Unless I hear different, yeah, I think that would help the bill.
Gentlemen, do you have other concerns about the piece of legislation?
I do have one question, Mr. Chair. It might relate to the Department of Public Safety, but it relates, I will ask first. This relates to Section 3 again. Are you going to have this is to Lieutenant Dial through the chair. Are you going to have any problem complying with the requirements in Section 3 for those areas within the state where there's no local police chief administrative office?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, are you referring to the local law enforcement officer basically approving the form?
Yes, sir.
I have seen those forms. My supervisor, who is a captain and supervises a detachment, which is basically Southeast Alaska, does review those forms. They have been approved. I'm sure that would be a policy call on the part of the colonel and the commissioner to make, but I don't see any.
Representative Grunberg.
I want to be sure on Section 3 that the troopers are able to comply with that in the 30-day window that's allowed. And then I was wondering if we have anybody here representing the police chiefs or whoever to make sure that the police chiefs around the state are able to do that. I don't know why they wouldn't, but I just would like it on the record if we have anybody there. I'm not holding the bill up.
We don't.
We do have the colonel here. Is that correct? I was wondering if either Lieutenant Dial or the colonel could verify that the troopers themselves would be able to comply with the 30-day requirement.
I think Lieutenant Dial can speak to that.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't personally feel as if I'm authorized to say that could be accomplished. I do not know all the technical aspects of that. I see no reason why it could not be accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colonel, privileged to have you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Audie Holloway. I'm the Colonel of Alaska State Troopers. And through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I see no reason why we can't comply with that 30 days if it comes to the troopers. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak for the chiefs of police, but I know that I have my captains and I, when we get these forms, these requests, we turn them around just as quickly as we can. It would be an exception if something didn't get out in 30 days.
But that answers my question. And I just, Representative Walker, through the chair, Has any police chief or anybody said they'd have any trouble with this?
I'm trying. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mike Hawker, with apologies, I neglected to introduce myself for your record earlier in this meeting, but I do represent District 32. Representative Grunberg, I have not had contact with any individual chief of police that is involved in signing these, or for that matter, one that is resistive to signing them. But I do, again, experience with the municipality of Anchorage shows that they historically have been able to turn these around within, you know, a 4 to 5 days a week period, maybe 10 days at the most, with an exceptionally detailed, thorough background examination. It is actually based on the examination they put recruit candidates through. So it, again, I have absolutely do not believe this is putting any undue burden upon any law enforcement agency.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm satisfied that I could with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 319? All right. Seeing no one, is there anybody else online? Do we have anybody online? Okay. So public testimony is closed. I want to move to some amendments. Representative Dahlstrom has asked to be able to vote on this bill, so I want to go through amendments, and then we will take an at ease. If she's not back in the room, she had to go up and speak to the speaker for a couple of minutes.
Oh, could I ask? Well, I'm sorry.
Representative Grunberg. Lieutenant Dahl, if you could hang tight for me for a second, please.
Representative Hawker, I was a little unclear on your dialogue with Representative Holmes. Are you going to be at some point narrowing the title of this, or what is your intent through the chair?
Representative Ramirez, Mr. Chairman, not Representative Grunberg. I am a tight title guy, always have been.
Right.
But I found it, you know, just interesting the last couple of times this sort of a bill has gone through the legislature, that it has gone through with the title, an act relating to firearms. And, you know, to that end, and I think in the allowing, as the sort of a bill goes through, to the good judgment of the legislature, I don't feel the need to add any additional protections to the bill to say, you know, we're trying to keep something, the proverbial, the fleas from growing on the bill. Because, quite frankly, as it moves through the process, if something is identified by any other legislator that would continue to improve the protections of Second Amendment rights for Alaska citizens, I would certainly welcome the discussion in any committee and the potentially making sure that I wanted to make this bill as available to them as a potential vehicle for a remedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose narrowing the title won't always do it. I'm reminded of predatory fish.
Yes. So let's move to amendments. Representative Gatto, you want to offer amendment number one, please?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll move conceptual amendment number one, page one, line four. Strike, provide a permittee with, and substitute mail A.
Is there an objection to amendment number one?
Just technically, yes. Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg objects.
I think it should be mail the permittee a notice. You have to say where you want it mailed.
Friendly.
Okay. If you'll make that correction, please, Susan. Is the objection maintained?
No.
Objection is removed. Amendment number one passes. I'd like to offer amendment number two, which is E.1 by Luckup. Is there an objection?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg objects. Lieutenant Dial, can you help us? Or Colonel, I don't know whether you want to come up and discuss this, or Lieutenant, if you want to try and catch this for me. An informal conversation last night with Colonel Holloway, which was very helpful, and the bill sponsor. My intention is to try and have a discussion about a concern that has been raised by some Alaskans with Amendment Number 2. And in an appropriate time, then I will withdraw Amendment Number 2.
Thank you.
We have a situation that has been brought to our attention that law-abiding citizens enjoying their Second Amendment rights are stopped by Alaska State Troopers, and we're delighted with the recruitment efforts over the last decade. We have a relatively young force, which was the objective of the legislative and the executive branch, and the people of Alaska benefit from having a burgeoning young force that's maturing. But with youth sometimes comes zealousness. We have law-abiding citizens who are informing law enforcement when they're stopped that they do have a weapon in the vehicle. And there have been concerns raised by citizens, and I'm told that there is a video of law enforcement then taking the weapon back to the car and checking for serial numbers. And it is a concern that's been raised by some constituent groups, including the NRA, that it is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, I believe. So I wanted to speak to it a little bit. The Colonel and I had a very constructive conversation about it last night informally. So I wanted to put it on the record, and I wanted to see if we could reach a point of view where we could create something in letter form, Colonel, so that we can better articulate this policy amongst the various detachments and the captains, and something that can come to the judiciary chair so that we feel like we're being responsive to the concerns of citizens. So if you can tell me what the policy is and why Amendment Number 2 is not necessary, I would be appreciative.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd first like to reassure the committee that as a routine practice, we are not seizing or retaining the firearms of Alaskans who are otherwise committing either minor offenses or engaged in lawful outdoor activities. The misconduct involving weapons in the fifth degree statute does allow us the ability to seize during the contact or ask that the individual secure a firearm in their possession. Certainly, that's a judgment call that the law enforcement officer makes at the scene, whether or not it's in his best interest to have that weapon in their possession or have the individual secure it. I can tell the committee, based upon the many posts I've served at over nearly 20 years, I would come across firearms in vehicles every day, and very few of those would I actually pull out of the vehicle. There were cases, though, that I felt the need to do that, not only for my safety, but because I felt that the actions of the individual that day may have been involved in a crime. For example, we get numerous reports on a daily basis of vehicles casing neighborhoods. If I was to stop a vehicle that was reporting as suspicious in a neighborhood, I would want to run that serial number, because in many cases that is going to link that individual to a burglary. And sometimes we can solve multiple burglaries that way. I would also suggest to the committee, too, that firearms are the one piece of property that over the course of time are more likely to turn up than just about anything else. They're valuable, they are very durable, and it's not uncommon for us to recover those that have been stolen in Lower 48. I would also like to say that when we actually run those numbers, all we are checking in our local state databases and national databases is for a match. Let's say we run the number 1001. If that does not hit a match, then that number really goes nowhere. It's not linked to a firearm. It's not linked to a person. So we really see that running of that number somewhat low on the intrusiveness scale. As far as policies, we can think about this. We can add some thought about trying to certainly use discretion when there is no other outside indicators that would suggest the individual is involved in some illegal activity, on whether or not we should run that serial number and bring those back. But we would certainly appreciate the ability to continue to do that, because it does allow us to solve a number of crimes every year.
We're all interested protecting the general public by allowing you that access. Specifically, what's been reported to me by some of the constituent groups that many of the members at this table work with is that is that police officers are taking the weapons back to check for serial numbers. Can you take me through, can you take the committee through a the difference between asking and what would be probable cause that you could secure a weapon and then go check for serial number, and what the distinction is, say, between Representative Dahlstrom for a routine stop and a more suspicious Representative Herron to my left, who's, you know, been casing the Judiciary Committee room, and draw that as a distinction for me so that the committee can better understand how the policy works out in the field.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As a supervisor and a former road trooper, I can assure you that the routine policy is we do not take those weapons back. We've become somewhat immune to the fact that most people have them. We know that's part of being Alaska, and I have never met a trooper that does not 100% support the Second Amendment. I agree that we may have some training issues with some of our younger people who may be, who certainly come out of the academy and field training at a higher level of officer safety. So we'd have to work at that. I can only say that it's a judgment call. Is there something about the individual, the circumstances of the traffic stop, their past criminal history, that would indicate that might be a good idea to run that. Unfortunately, I really can't go much beyond that because it's a judgment call, just pretty much like a judgment call whether or not we issue a citation in many cases.
Okay. Questions? So, Lieutenant Dahl, what I would appreciate is if you have our address, and I would appreciate just a letter from you clarifying that policy would be helpful to the committee and satisfying the concerns that have been brought to us, and then we can approach it from there. But that we would be grateful for that assistance. So with that, I'm going to withdraw Amendment Number 2. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Dahl. I appreciate it. Will we be able to get a letter from you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to withdraw Amendment Number 2. Are there any other amendments for House Bill 319? With that, the chair would look for a motion, please. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill Number 319-26-LS1273/E with attached zero physical note and individual recommendations.
And Representative Dahlstrom, we received, when you were out of the room, we did receive a fiscal note of $38,800 and then an ensuing fiscal note.
May I restate that then?
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill Number 319-26-LS1273/E with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Thank you.
As amended.
And seeing no objection, House Bill 319 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you, sir.
Back on the record, we are taking up House Bill 316. Annie, we got just a preview of this from Mr. Sabodny, but we would be grateful. We would be grateful to have you take us through this bill. We have an hour today, and we have wishing to testify Michael Wallery from Fairbanks, Watano Chiefs, Bill Burley from the Alaska Innocence Project, Barb Brink testifying on her own behalf, and then Doug Moody available for questions, Rebecca Brown and Steve Saloom from the Innocence Project, and then questions from folks at the State Crime Lab, and then Jeffrey Mittman from the ACLU. We have an hour left today. Tomorrow we have two pieces of business before us for an hour. We're going to review the potential identity theft loss for 77,000 state employees, how it happened, what the remedy is, and what we're doing to prevent it from happening again. Second hour of tomorrow's hearing, we will be taking up Harry Crawford's piece of legislation to work on red dots on adult driver's licenses and to put red hash marks on minors' driver's licenses to augment some work that we did a couple of years ago. Representative Harris?
Yes, sir. I've read the plan, but any amendments that my office may generate, do have them to your office by Friday?
For House Bill 316? It would be helpful, but it's not essential. We'll
attempt it.
Yeah, we'll see how we're doing. We have a full schedule for next week, and then we will fit in bills previously heard, and we're beginning to get bills from members, so we want to move through this very deliberately, but not to the exclusion of other business before the committee. And so I'm going to have Annie take us through the piece of legislation. Then I would like to begin to, if there's time left in the hour, then I'd like to begin to hear from those that are testifying.
Just on the scheduling, I wanted to thank you for, I'm sorry about that mix-up earlier today, and I know you're sensitive. The fact I have to be at transportation on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and when I know you're sensitive.
Thank you for recognizing that I'm sensitive. Annie, we missed you when you were in Washington, D.C. Nothing happens here without you. We miss you.
Oh, thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, I don't know what kind of an introduction Mr. Sawadney gave you on Monday.
Just a few minutes. You could just start over. It would be easiest for the committee,
okay.
I think.
This bill really is a balancing act. It addresses two important issues of law, one evidence retention and one post-conviction DNA testing. And both of those issues have countervailing considerations on either side. The evidence retention parts of the bill will adopt new requirements for law enforcement in our state to retain evidence that we don't have in current law. So we're trying to proceed cautiously because we're asking law enforcement agencies in big and little communities to save evidence for a significant period of time, so which is why we are starting out with the most serious of crimes and the ones that are most likely have evidence that could be that would be needed at a later date to possibly for a cold case prosecution or for a post-conviction DNA testing. The evidence retention provisions apply to, at this point, homicides and sexual assault in the first degree and sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree. And it divides evidence into two groups, what most people would consider evidence, the car, the wristwatch, the money, various things in a criminal prosecution, and biological material, which is the definition is pretty important, I think, and it's on page 5. It includes the contents of a sexual assault forensic kit, human body bodily materials, slides or test tubes taken from material. And another important part of this, it defines biological material as including cuttings or swabs from what you would otherwise consider evidence that are taken as samples of the material because, for example, if you have a rape in the backseat of a car, you can take cuttings out of the backseat material, but you don't have to keep the car away from whoever owns it, if it's not the defendant, and save that for a long period of time. So the periods and the treatment of these two different types of evidence is different. For regular evidence that you would consider, like the money or a watch or stolen property, although this only applies to felony crimes against a person, it requires that law enforcement keep that evidence until the time when there's no appeal process ongoing. It gives you a time up until you have time to apply for cert in front of the United States Supreme Court and a period after that. For biological material, however, and that includes not only the human bodily substances but cuttings and samples of material, this bill requires you to the police officers, police agencies, to keep this evidence until the person who is convicted of the crime has been unconditionally released from any incarceration. That means at the after probation it has been served and after any parole period has been served. And you can cut that in different ways. This bill, the governor's bill, generally tracks the federal law, but I think as Senator French's bill requires biological material to be kept until for the period of time the person has to register as a sex offender if it's a sex offense. And for Sam, a sexual assault in the first degree and sexual abuse in the first degree, that's their entire life. So the material would have to be held stored by law enforcement for the entire life under that bill. This bill is a little bit more limited. And as I think you have this chart in front of you, that it's really helpful. I think Mr. Sika prepared it. Another bill was introduced by Representative Lynn, provides that it has to be kept for the period of incarceration. So there are different ways to keep it, and you have different considerations based on law enforcement's abilities. It specifically provides that each police agency adopt a written policy for how they will approach taking of samples of evidence, so that they have written procedures and they follow them, and the procedures are in writing. You know, a little community is going to have different procedures from Anchorage or Juneau. Maybe I should ask at this point if there are any questions about evidence retention of evidence.
To go back to your last statement, Ms. Carpinetti, through the chair, that this is unfunded on a little community, and I see on the sectional analysis, this is a new and unfunded duty imposed on municipal agencies. I strongly support the retention of this evidence, but I'm also concerned about the fiscal implications on local law enforcement agencies and stuff. Has the department been working with them to see how much this would cost them and this sort of thing? I don't want to derail the conversation here, but I'd just like at some point that to be dealt with.
Through the chair, we have had conversations in the past years dealing with this bill and other iterations. And last year, there was not opposition by local police, municipal police officers to the provisions in the bill that's in the other body. I certainly can't answer for them, but we have talked to them about these provisions.
Chair.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carpinetti, I could see how this functions in the municipality or in any kind of community of size, Juneau, Ketchikan, et cetera. Because I worked collecting evidence for the fire department, and we had evidence cans. But the most important thing we did with that evidence was the chain of custody. Mm-hmm. If we were to consider a VPSO in a village, mm-hmm. conceivably they could collect and put things in cans. But the chain of custody is difficult for them. So is it possible that in communities we would have to have evidence lockers with chain of I forget what it's called, when you key, only one person has the key and they sign in and sign out? Would that be an almost impossible thing for us to do in a village?
Through the chair, I think VPSOs are certainly capable of preserving, and when you talk about chain of custody, what you really mean, has this evidence been preserved in a safe way so that it hasn't been tampered with? And I don't, Mr. Right. Holloway's here, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but I don't see any reason why VPSOs can't take good care of evidence. And one of the provisions in this bill establishes a task force of those agencies that regularly do take care of evidence, and the hope is that the task force will address the nuts and bolts of preserving evidence in a safe way so that, in 20 years, if it needs to be retested or if there's a cold case investigation that requires evidence, that it's been preserved so that it can be used in a fair way.
Thank you.
Reasonable way. So I will go on. The bill also allows a law enforcement agency, if they are unable or they want to return evidence, and you have to realize there could be a homicide where there's a car who I was thinking of it, my boss was thinking of this example earlier today. One car hits another car that hits another car and causes the death. A homicide results from the first car, and the middle car had really nothing to do with it besides being there. You know, you really, people want to get property back if it's possible. And right now, it's really hard. You know, our DAs, our prosecutors are worried about authorizing return of property. So the bill provides for a procedure for returning property if everybody is notified and nobody objects to the return of the property. And I think that will make a difference to owners of property that has gotten caught up in through no fault of their own. So it adopts a procedure for notifying people who have been convicted as a result of it, their attorneys, and the prosecuting authority. And it also, if there is an objection, it allows for a judicial procedure where they can ask the judge to consider the return of the property. The bill does provide at this point, you know, this is a new requirement for law enforcement agencies and for the state. So it provides if a law enforcement agency does not follow the procedure adopted, that the court may order the remedy it determines to be appropriate. It does provide, however, at this point, that based on solely on a violation of standards of retention, the court can't reverse a conviction. And then the definitions are pretty much self-explanatory. I think the most significant definition is what is included in biological material. And so if anybody wants to ask her any questions now about the evidence retention provisions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Or would you like me to just explain the bill and then answer questions later?
Yes.
Post-conviction relief. As you know, our procedures and current law were upheld by the United States Supreme Court, but it's probably a good idea that we have specific statutes in place dealing with post-conviction release, post-conviction DNA testing. And this bill sets standards. It is, again, a balancing test. It balances the right of a person in the unlikely event that he or she has been unjustly convicted of a crime to bring an application for post-conviction DNA testing against the rights of victims and other people to depend on perfectly good convictions and that have been fairly found. It adopts standards. It does require that an applicant file an affidavit saying that he or she is not guilty, did not commit the offense for which he or she was convicted, or any lesser included offense, or was not an accomplice, or did not have any other relationship to the crime. This bill provides that a person who has been convicted has had an opportunity for an appeal, has had an opportunity for post-conviction applications on other basis, should not get another opportunity to fine-tune the legal basis for the conviction. This is to allow a person who is actually innocent of the charges to have another opportunity to bring that in front of a court. There are people, and I'm sure the Innocence Project would like us to open convictions to fine-tuning what charge the person was convicted of, or fine-tuning a sentence in particular. This bill does not do that. This bill sets up a procedure for people who did not commit the crime to bring an application and have it heard in front of a court. An applicant under these circumstances has to file an affidavit saying, under penalty of perjury, saying that I did not commit the crime, and then he or she exposes himself to further prosecution if it is found that that post-conviction DNA testing confirms that that person committed that crime and is guilty of the offense. So there is a risk.
Representative Herron.
Thank you. Ms. Carpinetti, I understand that part of the bill, which I assume is, I see where it's added to the bill, but What about the people that eventually are found to be innocent, but they admitted they were guilty or pled guilty?
That's a good question, and I think that this bill, and maybe it's not very clear in the way it's drafted, but I would direct you to page or at, on page 9, line 22, paragraph 9. It says one of the things that a court has to find is that if the applicant was convicted after a trial, the identity of the perpetrator was a disputed issue at the trial. That indicates to me, and it did when it was being drafted, that people do plead guilty for other reasons other than the fact that they are necessarily guilty. But so that when I read this bill, I think that a person could have a guilty plea entered and still bring an application for post-conviction relief under the bill. But on the other hand, a person couldn't testify in court or during the trial that he or she committed the homicide, for example, in self-defense, and testify, you know, under oath, and then bring an application for post-conviction relief saying, I'm actually innocent, I didn't commit the crime at all.
Okay, Madam Chair, not a follow-up and then a comment. But, okay, so my office will work with you and others to maybe we can make some amendments in this section. The comment, Madam Chair, is many times on the floor, you and I get to talk, take the privilege of making comments about our spouses or our life partners, and it was nice to hear what your husband did for you today.
That it was nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
My wife should be so lucky.
Representative Lynn.
I share the concerns of Representative Heron, but on the lesser included offenses, I take that to mean if somebody is convicted, likely wrongfully, whatever, of homicide, that would include, the lesser included offenses would be manslaughter and the lesser degrees of the killing, not breaking into the house for burglary or speeding on the way to the, not every lesser included thing they could be charged with, but with different degrees of the actual homicide.
Through the chair, that's correct.
It doesn't go to other crimes en route to the alleged crime, to the alleged homicide. You know.
Yeah. Although this bill is limited to felony crimes against a person for bringing post-conviction relief applications. So you couldn't bring under this bill an application for post-conviction relief for felony DWI, but you could vehicular homicide crime.
Yes.
Because it allows applications for post-conviction relief for homicide crimes and for first-degree sexual assault and first-degree sexual abuse of a minor.
Right.
Follow up on that?
Well, again, you know, you break into the home, that's breaking and entering. You do all these things, and then eventually a homicide is committed by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the lesser included crime would not include the breaking and entering. Is that correct? Because that's not a homicide. That's breaking and entering, separate from the homicide. Mm-hmm. That would not be a lesser included offense, correct?
Through the chair, I believe that's correct. You know, a lot of these are really factually specific, but
yes, of course.
Yes, I believe you're
because
right.
Somebody could break and enter into the house, and not commit somebody else hiding in the closet and comes in and commits the homicide.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we're sort of skipping around in the bill at one mm-hmm. point. But I'm just focusing on the line 22 and 23,
page
9, because that's where Representative mm-hmm. Heron was focusing. And I could see a circumstance where a person might not have disputed the identity mm-hmm. because they had ineffective counsel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll want to think about that and see if we need to do something about the language of the bill. Cover that sort of thing. I don't know what's happened so much here, but certainly in other parts of the country, there have been lots of people convicted of murder and then subsequently brought applications for post-conviction relief on the basis that their counsel was ineffective and didn't raise a bunch of issues that they should have, and this might have been one of them. So I'd like to be sure that we cure that problem in this bill, because we could certainly have a case where you have a valid charge of ineffective assistance of counsel because they didn't raise the identity issue.
Well, ineffective assistance of counsel is another basis for bringing up an application for post-conviction.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm not familiar. I'm sorry.
It's actually post-conviction relief is a very complicated area of the law, and we have the attorneys in our office have a handbook on it because it's pretty
have
complicated. Have a handbook just helping us get through it because it's considered to be a civil procedure and
yeah.
It's very complex.
Thank you.
But there is another basis for post-conviction relief, and that is ineffective assistance of counsel.
And through the chair, and if that's the basis, then they could, if appropriate, get a DNA sample taken or used.
I believe so, yes.
We'll take a look at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, please proceed.
The DNA, post-conviction DNA testing portion of the bill is largely based on the federal law, similar to federal statute for post-conviction DNA testing. It requires that the evidence that is to be tested have been subject to a chain of custody so that it's has been preserved in a way that makes it reasonable to test it so that any results of testing it could be relied upon. It requires that the defendant or the applicant who's requesting it identify a theory of defense that is not inconsistent with the defense theory at trial, so that we're talking about balancing whether a person is able to say, you know, at trial it was self-defense, and then appeal that and have whatever post-conviction remedies are available for that, and then go back and say, actually, I really wasn't there. I'm totally innocent of this offense. So would you test the DNA for me now on that basis? So we're trying to, in a fair way, draw lines and balance who should be able to get this additional procedure for post-conviction DNA testing, and that's one of them.
May I inquire?
Representative Greenberg.
I noticed my friend to the left here was frowning, too, and I was just thinking
gesture.
About that. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
It could be, and I'm just, you know, we lawyers think of hypotheticals that may not seem all that usual.
Insatiable intellectual curiosity.
Well, it's the fact that we've seen so many strange things. I have in my practice.
I have in the legislature, too.
I have in this committee room, if we're all going to be candid.
Oh, why? Okay. But I could see some theory not being raised at a particular time because there wasn't scientific evidence that would support it then.
Mm-hmm.
I'm way ahead of myself. Please strike that. Let's just go ahead.
Annie.
Yes.
Please continue.
Okay. Let me just, maybe it would be helpful just to go through what the type of thing that an applicant has to include in the application for it to be considered. And that an affidavit, he or she must submit a sworn statement that they did not commit the offense or any lesser included offense, that they did not solicit another person to commit the offense or help or aid or abet in the planning or the commission of the offense, that the applicant did not admit or concede guilt in the offense in any official proceedings. And as I've said, the entry of a guilty plea, and maybe it needs to be clearer than that, you can enter a guilty plea, and that's one thing. It's another thing to testify on the stand that you did it or testify at a parole or probation revocation or a parole hearing, as Mr. Osborne did under oath, that admitting having committed the offense. And we believe that people should be responsible for those statements and not be able to say after that, oh, by the way, I would still like to have my DNA tested. He was unwilling, apparently, to ever say that he was guilty or innocent. He said, I'm either guilty or innocent, and the DNA testing will show this. We believe that people should be required to swear that they are innocent to get this new procedure for DNA testing. The application also needs to contain a description of what prior testing has been committed on that particular person or that particular piece of evidence.
Representative Lynn has a question.
I'm just curious, curiosity. If somebody's in jail for umpteen number of years for homicide, why would they be afraid of being charged with perjury? I mean, you're going to be in jail for longer?
Through the chair, it's for some people, this would not have any measurable effect, but for others it would.
You know, if I'm in jail for life or something, but then I have to put down under perjury, I didn't do it, is this going to concern me reasonably or logically?
Through the chair, it probably may not. It depends on the person. But, you know, a person has a lawyer, and they're an officer of the court, and they are responsible for.
It just doesn't make sense to me. But that's okay.
Okay. Any Representative Heron has a question?
Just on that point, where you just talked about you must declare, you feel that you must declare guilty or not guilty, is this a new phenomenon because of DNA testing? I mean, where they say, no, I'm not going to declare, we'll just let DNA tell us what I am. Guilty or not guilty? Is this a new phenomenon?
Well, that was, I don't think so. I think it's just, that was one of the things in the Osborne case that was so problematic. I mean, Mr. Osborne was unwilling to say that he was innocent. He said, I'm either guilty or innocent. And
based upon the DNA, excuse me.
And I want the DNA testing, and it'll show one way or the other.
Okay, thank you.
We believe a person at this point, I mean, this person has already had a trial or waive the trial for whatever reasons he or she wanted. They've had an appeal. They've had a possibility to petition to an even higher court, and they've had post-conviction relief remedies. At this point, another procedure should really be limited to people who are willing to say that they're innocent of the crime that they were committed of.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. And maybe this, because I haven't read the bill as much as I should have at all, really. Somebody's plea at the initial trial could have been guilty but not mentally responsible. And so in that case, they would have entered a guilty but plea. Would that bar them from later a DNA test?
Through the chair, under this bill, yes, it would, because they have admitted actually, now, let me think about that for a minute, because if
well, you can answer that later.
Yeah. Have you taken us through the bill? Because I'd like to do that, because we have a lot of people that would like to offer testimony. What I'd like to do is to integrate some of the public testimony to Annie's presentation and use that as the catalyst for a conversation, rather than just to probe the Department of Law. I'd like to get a contrast, because it appears that with the Innocence Project that we will enjoy some contrast testimony. So if you can take us through the bill rapidly so we can spend some time on getting to public testimony, I'd be grateful.
Okay. Let me just tell you what is required of a judge before he or she can order post-conviction DNA testing. The person, the crime has to be a crime against a felony against a person under AS 1141. The affidavits required in the bill have to be submitted. As we have discussed before, the person has not admitted or conceded guilt in an official proceeding. The evidence was obtained as part of the investigation of the crime, and either it has not been tested, or there was no waiver for tactical reasons, or it has been previously tested, but the applicant wants more specific DNA testing. The evidence was subject to a chain of custody, or in other words, it was retained under conditions that would ensure that any test given to the evidence would be accurate. The applicant has to propose a defense theory not inconsistent with the defense at trial, and that would establish innocence. If the defendant was convicted at trial, the defendant was the identity of the perpetrator. The perpetrator was an issue, and that there is a reasonable probability that the testing requested will produce new evidence that would support the new defense theory and could establish innocence of the person. That's the real basis of the bill in terms of post-conviction DNA testing. There are other procedure pr- procedural provisions. For example, timeliness. It presumes that an application brought within 3 years of conviction is timely. It presumes that an application after that is not timely, but it's not any kind of statute of limitations, because the bill provides that for any good cause it can be brought after 3 years. It sets out fairly complicated provisions for the testing once it's ordered. I don't think we need to go over that unless somebody has particular questions. And allows the prosecution and the defense to stipulate to post-conviction DNA testing. And the bill also makes corrective amendments to the AS 44-35-035, the database in Department of Public Safety for DNA. And those are pretty, they're mainly corrective and pretty minor changes, but I'm happy to discuss them if you'd like me to.
Okay. Questions? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be reading this incorrectly, but I'm looking at this timeliness, and it says you have 3 years to bring the application, or otherwise it's presumed to be untimely. But then I'm switching back to Section 3, which says they only need to hold on to the evidence for 18 months. That seems so they can get rid of the evidence after 18 months, although you have 3 years to bring
the claim. Well, it's the latest. It's the later of these various dates. And you know, our time, the time we have set is, you know, it's after the prosecution by a certain amount, but I was reading Mr. A description of it saying it's a destruction schedule. It is not. These are minimum periods that a law enforcement agency has to keep the evidence. That doesn't mean they won't keep it for longer, and for biological evidence, they keep it for till the person is released from probation or parole. So when we're talking about biological evidence and DNA testing, they will have it for definitely long enough based on both of those parts of the bill. And the timeliness provision is taken from federal law. It's a presumption. It's not a statute of limitations, and the bill provides that the presumption may be rebutted for any good cause after 3 years. So it's a pretty liberal timing provision. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go through the changes in the data database that the Department of Public Safety keeps for? Would you like me to go through those?
Sure.
Okay.
Representative Grimberg.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering some of this detail. Maybe do we want to take public testimony first?
A fine idea, Representative Grimberg. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's
would
see
you
if we
like me to stay here?
Yes,
or
please. Just stand by would be great. So we'd like to go to Rebecca Brown with the Innocence Project, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, if you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation, please. Try and keep your comments as brief as possible. We want to fit as many people in that have been waiting for an hour and a half.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Brown. I'm the policy advocate for the Innocence Project. I'm also joined on the telephone by Policy Director Stephen Saloom. And together we are hoping that we could just offer a national perspective on post-conviction DNA testing laws as you consider this one. And to date, there have been 250 individuals across the country exonerated by DNA testing. The latest exoneration took place just last week. Nearly all of these exonerations were made possible by the presence of a state-level post-conviction DNA testing law. Many, if not most, of the exonerated had to languish in prison, waiting until their state passed a post-conviction DNA testing law in order to prove their innocence. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Somebody calling for jail.
Many innocent men and women across the country still sit behind bars, subjected to the daily torture of prison life, and it seems incomprehensible given the fact that 47 states have passed DNA testing laws. But we've come to learn that many of the innocent are still barred from seeking testing because their laws are structured in a way to deny the very testing that was initially sought through the passage of those laws. And I really could go on further about how really what all this has demonstrated over time is the fallibility of human judgment over and over. People that, you know, even we believe seem guilty when we review their petitions turn out to be innocent and vice versa. And this is because, as with any system comprised of humans, errors are made. Our policy agenda is a pro-law enforcement agenda. We seek reforms that protect the innocent and identify the guilty. And in more than 40% of our cases, forensic testing, which excluded our clients, led to the eventual detection of the true perpetrators of those heinous crimes. Therefore, a robust DNA testing law that ensures access to all deserving applicants will help Alaska not only exculpate and free the innocent, but identify criminals. And I thought I would just turn to some of what we thought were the most troubling provisions in this, but I'd really like to say that the bill before you would require individuals seeking testing under the existing but insufficient post-conviction relief process to forego that process in favor of a DNA testing framework that denies nearly every, if not all, deserving applicant. And we think the most restrictive provision really relates to timeliness, which was just discussed. This does effectively put a 3-year statute of limitations from the time of conviction on filing a post-conviction claim of innocence. Nearly every single individual who is able to prove innocence through DNA testing had already exhausted every available state remedy as well as federal habeas corpus relief before seeking testing. Of our clients, nearly all of them had done that. So none of these individuals would have been eligible for testing under the framework that's contemplated in this proposal. And I think that's really one of the most crucial points here, that nearly every DNA exoneree in our country would not be able to get testing under this framework.
Okay.
There are so many reasons why people will not file a testing application within 3 years of conviction. Poor legal advice, illiteracy, a belief that the evidence wasn't collected or that it was not preserved, a mistrust of the criminal justice system, a lack of knowledge about the ability to perform testing. Under the proposal here, the timeliness requirement would have barred almost all the individuals around the country who've proven their innocence.
Rebecca?
There's not one law in the nation that includes such a restrictive timeliness provision.
Thank
and
you,
indeed,
Rebecca,
35 of the 47 existing statutes have no time limitation whatsoever.
No. Rebecca?
Yes.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Vermont.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We will look forward to hearing from some of the people in the Alaska Innocence Project in Anchorage. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks.
Can we go to Michael Wallery next in Fairbanks with Tano Chiefs Conference, please?
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Wallery. I'm General Counsel for Tanana Chiefs Conference. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. At the current time, Tanana Chiefs Conference is opposed to SB 316 in its current form. The concern really is based on a number of issues. One is our reading of the Osborne decision is that, maybe bluntly put, that there is no constitutional right to prove innocence, and that it's up to the states to develop the standards. But when we're talking about DNA, we're talking about a very accurate science where the proofs of identity can be actually shown beyond a reasonable doubt. We see the tension here a little differently between two interests. One is the interest that the innocent should not be punished, as opposed to the administrative expense and inconvenience of retaining evidence, biological evidence, and having to deal with redundant or frivolous testing requests. The Native people, I think the committee is quite well aware that the Native people of Alaska are highly disproportionately represented in the incarcerated population. And the balance for the Native community really tips heavily in favor of protecting the innocents because of the concern over whether or not, or concern over the proportionality and what many believe to be a disparate treatment of Native American people in the Alaska criminal justice system, which has been documented over and over. With that regard, it's our position that a person should have a right to prove his innocence, somewhat at odds with the recent decision of the Supreme Court, but that inconsistent with that view is that the procedural barriers in state statute should not limit the right of people to prove their innocence. We believe that this bill in several instances actually does that. It creates procedural barriers that would prevent truly innocent people from coming forward to showing that. And of course, we've had heard a lot of discussion about that. But the two largest issues in the bill that we have concern with relate to the destruction of evidence. In particular, we have some serious concerns on page 4 of the bill, starting on line 1 down through line 19. And we tend to think that it has it backwards, that if an agency is going to destroy biological evidence, that it really should have a court procedure involved in that, so that the court is making sure that the protections for the innocent are assured. The other major issue we have has to do with the findings. A number of these findings are really barriers to bringing post-conviction relief, and we would disagree with the department's characterization of this. Within the Native community, we constantly hear of concerns over lawyer ineffectiveness of counsel, I'm surprised many times looking into these matters that I find that very good lawyers have done very good jobs, but on occasion things slip through the cracks. The whole issue of whether or not an attorney decides to take a Cooksey appeal, which anybody who took a Cooksey appeal under this would be prohibited from bringing a post-conviction relief based upon innocence. Issues about the standards related to what you have to show, that you have to show that there's conclusively established that an applicant is innocent, as opposed to the fact that reasonable doubt exists in a situation. Complete within this list of items on page 8 and 9, really the central issue is the effectiveness of counsel. A curious element is the chain of evidence that we see on line 14 on page 19, an error in the chain of custody, which is fully within the government's control, would actually, the burden of that would be borne against the applicant, and could actually be a basis for denying post-conviction relief. The other issue that we've talked about is timeliness, and I'm not going to, I think we would agree with the earlier comments that timeliness, if a person is incarcerated and they can prove their innocence, that should not be deemed untimely as a matter of legal presumption. And finally, I would take a look at, I would urge the committee to take a look at the task force that's set up. There is no defense bar on this. This is a highly biased task force designed to advance the interests of prosecution. And that is greatly disturbing to us, and we'd like to see a little bit more balanced representation within that task force. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Michael, I think you've raised some interesting issues for the committee and public testimony to better frame some of the tension that exists in trying to provide something and yet not overwhelm our Department of Law. And although many of us are advocates for building the crime lab, we also have to be mindful that presently we don't have one. And so I find that this bill is presents a balance and a beginning, and that we shouldn't see this as a mature, necessarily the mature end product, but in fact an incremental progress bill is the way that I see it as the chair. And I'm afraid that if we overreach for this thing, that we will begin to overwhelm the existing resources. And at the appropriate time, that's going to be the question that I have for Michelle Collins and Tony Otten, and Oren Dim, who are with the existing state crime lab. Representative Gruenberg, you have a question?
Yes. Mr. Wallery, and also this is for Rebecca Brown. Rebecca, are you still on the line?
No, Rebecca is not available to
us. No, wait a minute.
In Vermont.
Mr. Gruenberg, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Gruenberg, can you please direct your question to Mr. Wallery?
Let me tell you what I'm going to ask. So before you
Mr.
get upset.
Representative Gruenberg, we're going to be done in 10 minutes. You can tell me then. Would you direct your question to Mr. Wallery?
I'd like to have them put their testimony in writing. That's what I'm going to ask them to do. May I do that?
We have it.
May I do that?
Would you direct your question to Mr. Wallery, please? I'm sure they heard.
Okay. Mr. Wallery.
Thank you.
Would you and anybody else who's listening,
thank you,
including Ms. Brown,
well said,
please put your testimony in writing and any specific problems you have with the bill by page and line and any suggested amendments, and please get them to us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I would be more than glad to do that.
Well said, Mr. Wallery. All right. Are there any more questions for Mr. Wallery? All right. Next, can we please go to Bill Oberle, or let's go to Barb Brink first in Anchorage, and then we'll come back to Mr. Oberle with our time. Barb Brink?
This is Bill Oberle. Barb Brink had to leave.
Okay. Mr. Oberle, feel free. If you'll introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bill Oberle. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Innocence Project. And I'd like to give a local perspective of House Bill 316 as written.
Thank you.
The mission of the Alaska Innocence Project.
If you have any written testimony, we would love to receive it at the conclusion of this meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I submitted written testimony, as did Rebecca Brown. Does the committee have copies of that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't.
Representative Holmes does not. We will work that out and get copies of that at the conclusion of this meeting in 10 minutes. So if you will share with us your remarks, please.
Thank you. The mission of the Alaska Innocence Project is to identify, investigate, and exonerate individuals who have been wrongfully convicted in Alaska. So you can imagine how important evidence preservation and post-conviction DNA testing legislation is to us. In fact, those two are the most important issues for us. Because they allow us to carry out our mission. But at the same time, the converse is true. A bill that restricts post-conviction DNA testing or gives illusory access condemns the innocents to no relief and makes justice in Alaska illusory. I commend Governor Parnell for recognizing the need for Alaska to have a post-conviction DNA testing bill, but unfortunately, House Bill 316, as currently written, does not provide reasonable access to post-conviction DNA testing. It provides that illusory access that I spoke of. As written, House Bill 316 would be the most restrictive DNA testing law in the United States, and, interestingly enough, more restrictive than the current process. In other words, an individual trying to prove their innocence in Alaska would be better off with no law than with this law. Specifically on the contents of the bill, the timeliness requirement on page 10 calls for a three-year, basically, time limitation. I disagree with the state who wrote this, that their language says that it can be accepted but for any good cause. It does not say that. It says other good cause. That is a significant linguistic difference. If a court is interpreting this, they're going to look to the first exception, and that calls for the applicant being incompetent or incompetent substantially contributing to the delay. That is a serious situation. Any other good cause would have to be as serious. If the state means for it to have any good cause, then it needs to amend its language, because as it is written, it is going to bar a number of people from being in action. As we sit at this hearing, there are likely innocent men and women in prison in Alaska with their cases undiscovered and undeveloped. I can tell you from my experience, this is a long process. As an example, the first case that the Alaska Innocence Project has filed for testing, which is working its way through the courts now, was filed 9 years after the last court hearing. I just don't don't understand the deadline on innocence being put into this bill. 35 of the 47 states who have passed legislation don't have one. If an innocent claim meets the standard and evidence can be located to be tested, what does Alaska gain by putting arbitrary time limits on such actions?
Okay.
Time should... Excuse me?
I said you made that point. Can you go to your next point? We only have 10 minutes, and we'd like to fit in a little more...
The next point is the restriction, if evidence wasn't tested at the trial level on page 9. I find this restriction to be particularly troubling because it not only perpetuates bad lawyering by making an individual pay the price for a bad decision, not just because it punishes those who pay for their own defense and can't afford testing, but also because it allows the prosecution, the holder of the evidence, the prosecution who has had its access to the crime lab to do the DNA testing, to not test evidence, and then to deny access to an individual for post-conviction DNA testing. If a criminal trial is truly a search for the truth and evidence exists which might contain DNA, then failure to test is as much the fault of the prosecution as the defense, perhaps more so since they hold the evidence. So why should a statute such as this, which punishes a potentially innocent person for something that the prosecution is at least equally responsible for?
Hey, Bill, what's the mission statement of the Innocence Project?
Relevant here, as I said at the start, it is to investigate, identify, and exonerate wrongfully convicted individuals in the state of Alaska. Another particularly troubling part is the restriction on those who pled guilty or admitted guilt. Again, the state has written this bill, but their interpretation is not as they have written. This does not, by its language, prevent someone who has pled guilty from not bringing an action, did not admit or concede guilt in any official proceeding. That is certainly a hearing in court. So if they mean to exempt people who plead guilty, they have to clean up that language. And even so, I think that those who admit guilt, even in other official proceedings, is overrepresented by the vulnerable, the young defendants, the disabled, the very individuals government should protect, yet in this law, they are far from being protected. And of particular concern to the Alaska Innocence Project is the real and significant impact these restrictions are going to have on Native Alaskans with claims of innocence. Because I believe there are likely to be a number of Native Alaskans who are innocent of the charges for which they were convicted who haven't been identified yet. And given the relationship of Native Alaskans to the criminal justice system, a high percentage of these cases will involve pleas or admissions of guilt. And due to budgetary restrictions and remote Bush representation, criminal defendants are likely to not have DNA testing. So I don't believe that the terms of this legislation are race neutral, and they will have a much greater negative impact on Native Alaskans. This bill also contains indirect restrictions, like at pages 3 and 11, where it requires an applicant to pay for retrieval of evidence. The closest comparison I can make to a person claiming innocence having to pay to retrieve the evidence that might prove their innocence is making a rape victim pay for her own rape exam. We know that is just plain wrong, and so is this. This will bar many claims. And I think, as Rebecca Brown had started, the requirement that a judge guess at the outcome of testing to decide if it should be allowed at page 9 is just really perplexing to me. I couldn't find any other statute in the country which contains this, and I'm not sure where they where this came from. Finally, I think that the task force that was listed in Senator French's bill really dealt with, among other things, retention of evidence. And that should be part of this task force, and this task force should be expanded out to those people who have knowledge about that, including members of the defense bar, members of the innocence community. You may wonder how we can have such a different view of this statute as the Department of Law, and I think it comes from the philosophical viewpoint we approach from. Mr. Svobodny described the Department of Law's approach on Monday, and I wrote it down when he was introducing the bill. He said, this law restricts the number of cases that can get DNA testing now or could have gotten DNA testing. So the state set out to restrict the number of cases who would get testing under this law, and this version certainly did that. I mean, I think that that intention is confirmed by their zero fiscal note. They do not expect any cases to come out of this. Alaska Innocence Project, on the other hand, looks at this statute as an opportunity to find those wrongfully convicted in the state of Alaska and hopefully identify the real perpetrator of those crimes. That requires a statute without significant restrictions like this one. I think this law can be salvaged if the sections I've described above in my presentation are amended and we truly allow innocent individuals access to DNA testing that may prove their case. So with those comments, I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. That's an extraordinarily cynical interpretation of this legislation, but I thank you for your perspective. Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chair, did you say that was cynical?
Representative Lynn.
Wow.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. As you know, I have a direct, very strong interest in this bill and allied bills, one of which is the bill that I submitted. And the emphasis has been, you know, getting the innocent out of jail, and that's a worthy goal. But I think we have this thing backwards, and I've said this from the very beginning when I filed my bill, and I say it now, and I'm going to repeat it when we get toward the end of this hearing. My object is to get the guilty in jail, because if you have an innocent person in jail, you got a guilty person out there running up and down the street. So we want to get the we want to do whatever we can to get the guilty folks in jail, and as a corollary, get the innocent folks out of jail. That's the direction that we ought to be going. It's to me, it's a public safety issue as well as an issue of justice for the person who's wrongfully in jail.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Comments?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
I do not think that testimony was cynical, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And I agree.
Me too.
Are there any questions for Mr. Oberle?
Just one.
Yes.
I've reviewed, and I apologize that I did not, my staff said that Rebecca Brown did have her testimony. For all these people, if they could get their specific language concerns really focused and proposed amendments really clear, that would just help us because we've got so many witnesses here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And any more questions for Mr. Oberle? Mr. Mittman, have you been standing by all this time?
I have, Mr. Chair.
It's 3 p.m. We enjoy the committee enjoys hearing from you. We're happy to bring you back when we take up this piece of legislation. But you've been standing by. Would you care to offer a few cursory remarks about this, just to kind of frame your comments?
Certainly, actually, in light of the time, I think at this point we will provide written testimony and join the really well thought out comments of Mr. Wallery and Mr. Oberle. We concur essentially in their analysis, and at a time that's appropriate for the chair, we'd be happy to expand on those remarks.
All right, thank you very much, Jeffrey. I appreciate it. We don't have anybody else that has requested to testify today, so we will not close public. We'll not close public testimony, but I think we've done an adequate job of framing the tension that exists in this piece of legislation. It's several minutes past 3 o'clock. We're going to adjourn for the afternoon, and we will convene here again at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you.
We've got an hour free here.